Okay, everybody relax. You had a break. Good. Yeah, I'm okay. I squeezed in 10 conversations. So. I thought, you know, adults learn best by expressing themselves. And so there's a microphone here. And it might be good just think about how what I was saying touches what you're up to, maybe as a community. Or as a generation, or as Santa Barbarians. so maybe if you have any questions or comments, you can just keep them short, and here's the microphone. That would be great. Don't be intimidated to step up. It looks imposing here, but...
We had an article appear in the Los Angeles Times in the past week, and the title was something to the effect of raising your children without religion is just fine.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if you could bounce that off your own experience.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, that's a very good one. It's very popular right now, or in vogue, to kind of bash religion, because what has been going on in Paris and what has been going on for the last, I don't know, 10,000 years. and so I have gone through all the phases in my life talking with people who brand themselves as atheists. I get really combative with them in the past, and because I needed to defend my own faith. So when you're insecure, you have to fight. You have to prove something, defend something. And there's plenty on both sides. There's a lot of dead people, a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, historically on every side, however you turn it. Wherever human beings are involved. So I tell them, look, sometimes people say I'm spiritual but not religious. I tell people I'm religious trying to be spiritual. Because I don't know if I'm spiritual. I want to be. It's my aspiration. It's something that I live into and practice. But I don't declare myself like that. And religion is there as structure to help me on my path. Religion is simply when spiritual people get together and exchange their opinions, tips, dangers, art, rituals, that religion is born. Religion is simply the shell around the pearl. It's not the pearl, but it's a shell. But without shell, there is no conversation about pearl. Religion is... it would be like saying, you know, I like education, but I don't like schools. Or I like knowledge, but I don't like education. You know, religion is simply the way we have organized our meaning. And if you would remove religion, there will be way more wars. Because before the religion was there, it was everybody for their own, and then it just didn't work like that. And even people who are atheists and humanists today, I have a lot of friends who are organizing congregations, and I actually consult atheist groups on how to build a congregation. Because atheism and humanism is also a system of meaning. You know, when you doubt something, it comes from some other belief. So whatever, you cannot just doubt in a vacuum. You have to believe in something. You need to stand on something. So what do you stand on? If you are standing on saying, look, you know, we don't believe in God. What do you believe in? You cannot say, you cannot put your faith around unicorns that don't exist. You know, like, so that's one level of conversation. And religion gives us a way to express what we value, what we think is beautiful, what we think is right, what we think is wrong. Society, and that's why we fight around religion, because religion gives expression to our stories and cultures and meanings. If you would remove that, we would have fights in some other way. They'll be just less organized. and potentially more deadly. Because there will be no levels, there wouldn't be hierarchy, there wouldn't be conversation, there'll be all just happening. So my daughters, I mean, they are Christian. My older one, I'm from sort of Protestant background, and they're baptized when they're teens, and they both grew up in interfaith environment with me, and they baptized as Christians, and because they know that if you don't embrace a story will be imposed on you. Because there's thousands of people paid $1 million on Madison Avenue to put the story in your head. Billions of people spending in Hollywood to put their stories in your head. So you just want to choose your story. Okay, you don't want to raise your kids religious? How are you going to raise them? Well, not religious. Well, that's nothing. That's like saying my identity is post-fundamentalist. Like, what are you for? Like, what are you for? How are you going to raise them? That's fine. And the moment you go into how you're going to raise them is the moment you're going to latch yourself onto a story, into practice, into your opinion, into indoctrinating them, what's good, what's bad. You're not going to tell them, look, you might as well, you can respect old people or not. It doesn't matter. No, you're going to teach them to respect the grandparents, right? Why? Why would you respect grandparents? Because we as humans have learned over a long period of time that without respecting the elderly, society falls apart. There's strength there. Without telling stories, listening to the stories of the elderly and having children dance, like every tribe in the middle has a fire and children are dancing and elderly are telling stories, and that's how every tribe survives. Everything else is cosmetics. Everything else exists to preserve that. And so you will have your tribe, you will have a fire in the middle, you will have your dances, you will have your stories. And you also say religion is broken, simply because made out of the broken human beings. So, apologies. I'm sorry. Sometimes I'm with Protestants, they say, well, Catholics have done this and that, and Catholics have, the Inquisition and blah, 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 and we are different. Like, really? First of all, read the history, number one. Number two, it's you. It's you. So when people come to me and say, Christians have done this in a 10th century, I'm like, first, I wasn't there. Second, none of my people were there. And we Protestants kind of protested against that. So we are the good guys. We are good guys. No, I don't do that. If somebody who is not a Christian tells me about that, I said, I'm sorry. We all broken. We all do these things. We have done that because these and these reasons, and it was wrong. You own up to religion. You do not defend religion. You own it. You own it. Islam. I have my Muslim friends. I tell them, look, Islam is not a religion of peace. And they're all like, how can you say that? It's not politically correct. You should say Islam is a religion of peace. No, it's not. It's a religion of war, and it's a religion of peace. Christianity is a religion of war, and it's a religion of peace. It's up to you. It's up to you. So defending religion, so that's one of the issues with the younger religion, such as Islam, that it needs time to kind of own up to both parts, sort of thing. Okay, yeah, that was a long answer, but covered ground. Thank you.
Thank you for that, and thank you, Tom, for asking that. There was a good article written by an Episcopalian priest. There was a great article written by an Episcopalian priest about 20 years ago that was entitled, Can We Be Good Without God? Mm-hmm. And he said it could probably only last about a generation. Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. otherwise it becomes Santa Claus. Our moral code becomes Santa Claus. Uh-huh. And he said a lot more about it. But I wanted to thank you very much for just being you and for your words. And I, as a young girl, I was born and raised in Los Angeles. I was born of a Mormon mother, a Catholic father, in a Jewish neighborhood. And I married a Buddhist and Methodist, into a Buddhist and Methodist family. And in so many ways, I had the boundaries, I had the choices, and all of those people made me who I was and who I am today. And you honored that experience. Mm-hmm. And there's so many of us in this country and around the world that are intermarrying, mm-hmm. and are giving our children those experiences. And I'm finding, as a school teacher, as a campus minister at UCLA, one of the big diversity schools, these children are coming to us with spiritual experiences beyond comprehension. And some of my students came from Asian countries that did not have the Christian words for their experiences. So oftentimes in spiritual direction, I would just offer them, was it like this? Was it like that? This is a Christian perspective on that. And some of them, it was just a wonderful exchange of spirit, is what I'd have mm-hmm. to say.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And I have to say also that your book, as well as other experiences, my own story, has inspired me to start a place called Child Spirit Rising, where we start listening to the spiritual stories of children. Mm-hmm. And taking them seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that will be one of the processes where religion, this container you're talking about, will gain respectability also. Mm-hmm. So
right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank
Thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to share a personal story how God came to me sideways, and in the process I also found out that we have a direct link to God and that we often just don't know. I take adult ed classes, and the teacher is non-religious, and he's a real expert in guiding people into deep meditation. And when I did one of my first ones with him, I was going through a change and looking for more than my Catholic faith was providing. And in that meditation, he had us go to our inner home and our inner life. And the first door I entered was the past, and I'll skip that. The second door was the present, and when I opened it, it was kind of open to the universe. And I don't know why, but I just jumped. And later on, I realized it was a kind of a leap of faith. And then the third door led me through a dark hallway. And at the end of the hallway was the door. And I opened it, and I found myself on a scaffolding on the third story of a house from the outside. Mm-hmm. And I looked out, and there was the desert. And I climbed down the scaffolding and walked into the desert, and I felt a call to sit down and meditate while looking at the far horizon, and there were mountains there. And later on I went over it with the teacher, and he said it was a call towards the desert, and that the fact I came down the scaffolding was accepting the challenge, the journey. And that the meditation was the way to go through the journey. So I found it rather marvelous to have these images come within us, answering the very questions I was asking myself at the time. So it was a totally non-religious person who opened to me a door to answers mm-hmm. to the mm-hmm. very questions mm-hmm. my life was calling.
Yeah. If you notice in the New Testament, Jesus never talks about spiritual life. He always talks about life. We have slapped the word spiritual on it so we can compartmentalize it and exclude something from life. And so religion is just part of life. It's not something that's... I have a chapter in my book, God Management Systems. So religion is not there to manage life. It's just... It's part of it. It's like everything else. You cannot just uproot it. You cannot just put it away. You cannot separate it. And in that experience, you know, I hear you. A person who is not religious has took you there because people like that teacher, probably don't have hang-ups about religion. They understand that. They say, yeah.
The scaffolding meant also that I didn't have to leave my story. It was just being transformed, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. It was very comforting, you know. Mm-hmm. I knew exactly at that point then felt mm-hmm. safe. I had started to meditate and mm-hmm. I knew that was a big part. Yeah. So anyway.
Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing. How about one more and then we'll maybe take it in some other direction. Yeah.
Samir, first of all, thank you so much for being here, for honoring us with your presence. Could you say a little more about how you, or what you said to your own children about approaching the strangers on the...
Okay. All right. I mean, we have a lot of like role play stuff, and they heard me talk about this in an abstraction, you know, like this a number of times. Well, it started first with when you get out of the building, you know, how it's about safety sort of thing. And so first lesson in safety was when we hold them by hand and we walk, don't step into dog's poop in New York. You know, like that's like first thing. Then it was kind of a guidance to cross the street because they need to do that so many times, you know. And then how to get in the subway, how to get in, how to this, where in a car to go. We teach them where there's a person in the middle. You know, you teach them a lot of these ropes, and it's a very, very sort of systematic nuts and bolts way to go about it. And they would still make mistakes, you know, like... A young man would come to my daughter and start to talk to her that he knits diapers for his daughter, and she starts talking to him, and they start walking together, and she walks him home for me to give him money. You know, like, so that kind of thing. Or somebody's standing on the side, and we tell them, look, you know, when you are with a person, I would go out. But there are so many things we have done. Like, for example, let me just give you like ideas how we process that. First of all, there's so many homeless. And they are the most sort of present strangers there. Because nobody, you know, relates to them. There's tens of thousands of people you meet every day. And New Yorkers need to just go into their trajectory. Otherwise, if you look in every person's eyes and say good morning, you're never going to arrive. So you have to sort of isolate yourself into a certain space, like a bubble, and move through. But you cannot be in your bubble if there's people who need you, like homeless. You know, they depend on us. So we told them, look, so we would have a big jar when we would collect money for the homeless, and they would always fill up their pockets, and they're always in the subway, and some of them are fun, and all of that kind of thing. But then I would take her, when they were small, I would take them out, and there was this guy kind of lying on the street, and we would say, okay, let's ask him, let's go together, you'll be safe, and let's talk to him. So we, you know, all sort of squat down and say, what would you like, you know, we ask him questions. And he says, well, how did he come to be homeless? And he says, I came to be homeless because when I was, because I cannot get around, my body is just all sort of, you don't see it, but it's all burned. I said, well, how it's burned? Says, well, I was, when I became a homeless, you know, I was all still in energy, but I was lying on a bench, and some teenagers came and poured the gasoline over me and set me on fire when I was sleeping. And so my daughters are like, you know, it's a shocker. I mean, I process with that later. And then what do you want? He says, well, he wanted papaya dogs and a papaya drink. So we bought that, and we all bought it for ourselves and sat down with him on the street. And just had a conversation and ate those things. So, things like that. Then they would prepare like a gift bags for homeless, and they would just put it next to them when they're sleeping. But we asked them to do whatever they want, they put in. So they would put, like, I don't know, $5, you know, $5 from their saving, and they would put the toothbrush, you know, all stuff like that, food. And then one of them put Oreo cookies. I was like, nah, Oreo cookies, that's not nutrition, you know. Let's put something, you know, some like Kind bar or something like that. And you know, well, she liked Oreo cookies, so she's going to give him Oreo cookies, you know. Okay. So we put it, and they put it, and then next day we are going to this Rite Aid, and we're in the Rite Aid, and there's this homeless guy there. He has $5 that he got into the from the bag, and he has a big box of Oreo cookies. He wants more. That was so good. So, you know, but we try to really teach them to sort of learn to depend on other people. It's equally important as to be independent. It's a systematically you got to teach them that. Yeah. Anyway, well, thanks for those questions.
Okay, does anybody else have any questions?
All right.
Then I will ask one.
Okay.
I'm an expert at this. One of the things that we're all here involved with is doing some kind of work in the community to express our way of living. Is there any overall general hints you can get on how we can make more of a difference in this world?
That's a very big question. How to make life meaningful? Well, you know, I mean, the sometimes it's intuitively you know what to do, and you intuitively have been doing it. That's why this group is so lively, generous, hospitable, warm. You have something going on. I mean, I've not been felt this welcome often, you know. I mean, I've been welcome, but there is something, even from hearing the story of where you, how you came together, there's life that brings you together, and you followed your intuition. I would say if you need to sort of decide what to do next strategically, would be like a value would be you got to do it with the community and what community wants and what you want. It has to be what you want, so you're excited about it, so you don't go out and say, oh, well, they need this, and then everybody's like, but if your intuition says, yes, we really want to do that, you feel it, you light up, you know, and then your reasons say, yeah, this is needed, and there are steps to this, this is possible, you know, and then your fear says, hell no, then that's good. You know, do something that scares you, but that lights you up, and that reasonably, if you use your reason, it is good, you know. But if it's something that's not scaring you, you will not move on, you know, in a sort of directed manner. Whoever organized this had probably that kind of a stepping it up was the same similar process. So, and you can invite community actually to do it. Like when I was on the Upper East Side, we organized so many concerts. Like we brought Juilliard Orchestra, you know, all the blows and whistles, and have all these spectacle going on, and thinking that will involve people, you know, that will attract people to our congregation. And people were like, just like New York, you know, I mean, I can go, I have tons of other choices on Wednesday evening, you know, or anytime. So what we did instead, we actually asked people to help us. So we said, oh, well, why are we paying musicians and bringing them in? Let's go to the community, find all these musicians that are great, and tell them to come for free, and that the people will come and we'll charge them, and then we'll give money to a good cause. We'll give money to the firemen that were there. I was for September 11 there. That's a whole other story. But, you know, we would give it to them. The church was full. You become a broker of goodwill. You're sort of like, you become a dealer, you know. You become a dealer. You find what's needed, and you find, you know, and then you just kind of a broker for that, but you have to smoke what you're selling as well, sort of thing. You know, you like, you need to sort of enjoy it, you know, and be part of that and do something that moves you. Being somebody who helps community, that's the best of all worlds. Yeah.
I was going to share with you that we learned something from New York in Santa Barbara. Though it looks beautiful, and it is, there are many homeless people here, obviously, and people who are living in their cars. And so this very next weekend, we are going to be doing a survey where we used to survey the homeless, turn in numbers, get money. You know, that was it, and they were numbers. And now we interview all of these homeless people, and we have a what we call a vulnerability index, where we ask them questions, have you been in the emergency room in the last 5 months, et cetera, et cetera. And then we put it all into a bank, and we have the most vulnerable people that we house first when housing becomes available. And so I've been helping get a group together to survey the people in cars, who live in cars. And what you say is so true. They are the stranger to us. Mm-hmm. And in the last two surveys, they've become this. I remember writing in my journal, they were no longer the homeless people, but the painter and the musician, and you know. And so, but it's very difficult to get people in faith communities to cross that border. They would rather give money or build or cook something and take it to transition house, which is all good things. But to actually personally encounter the stranger, even in a very safe setting, like it's very organized the way we go out and do it, it's a very, very big challenge for all of us. Mm-hmm. And if only somehow we could figure out how to get your message of they have so much to offer us, it would be wonderful. Yeah. I don't quite know how to do it. I haven't been greatly successful, but we'll try.
I mean, some of the ways to do it, I'm executive director of Faith House. We do like immersions in New York City, so we bring groups from a congregation or from a government sponsored groups or school or seminary. They come, and then we organize like 24 hours, 40 hours, 72 hours of immersion, and we immerse people into the local community, sort of like having New York as a city of pilgrimage where this very authentic different religious communities are, and then we help people enter sort of from below, like sideways, from the ground up, and they have that experience, like a dancing with Jewish renewal congregation, and you know, twirling with Sufis, and you know, but not watching them in some sort of a show, but going in a small local community and being with them, and then they process that. So when you're immersed, everything changes because you need to reconstruct the way you see everything, because when you meet people. The same thing with the LGBT community, same thing with the Muslim community. Everything changes once you know three people, even one. Everything, the whole conversation is over. It's just like you come from a completely different space. Like you have, where have I been? You know? So immersion is a good thing. But immersion is very demanding on a person, because it asks you to mature and hold your things loosely and be more like be than what you do. You know, see yourself who you are rather than what things are going on around you. And we call it, experience the faith of others and deepen your own process, sort of. Because your faith deepens through that. So what you might want to do instead is bring three homeless people right here. Read a book about homeless, bring three of them and interview them for an hour. Everything. How did they become homeless? Where did they go? What did they try? How did they go about things? Find people who are willing to, or maybe people who have broke out of homelessness, and then their journey, so you understand what's possible and what's not possible. It's powerful when you hear them. I was in the meetings, we organized interfaith meeting for homelessness, and people came and gave the whole story. And then that's a step, you take them into that space. And you hold them by the hand. Then after that, you can say, hey, let's go and meet them, and let's organize this, and let's organize that. Let's organize art where they can come express themselves. And you find organizations in which you play a small part on a bigger journey they have. You can never... It doesn't make sense to go and help. It's much more... There's 10 steps for them to come from here to here, and you help one step, and there's bigger organizations you can be part of to help that step. And surely housing is, they discovered, is the first and most important thing. You know, it's not like, oh, you'll get a job, educate yourself, get your ID, and then we'll give you housing. Like, what? If I knew all of that, I wouldn't be homeless. So that's that thing. So bring them in, tell stories. They would be willing to do that. They might be scared. They might not, you know, want to be exposed like that. But you have to befriend them, which is your task as a leader, and make them trust, you know, and be trusting, and it's good, yeah.
If anyone is interested, the material is out here. We still need, you know, volunteers, and it's a very safe thing to do.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, yeah. Yeah, do that. Let's put it this way. If you don't have a stranger in your life, find one. You know, practice the presence of the other. Not just practicing the presence of God. Sometimes practicing the presence of God is like, oh, I'm going to remind myself of all the nice, warm and fuzzy things, you know, rainbows and lollipops in my life, and, you know, good things. But strange things, things that you don't understand, questions you have never been asked, you practice that. I call it holy awkwardness, you know. If you don't have spaces where you're awkward, you don't know how to behave, you don't know what to do, you don't know what to say, you're kind of lost in that space. That's a good space. It's like going to gym. It's a spiritual gym. You come to a place where you'll just grow stronger. You'll just grow deeper. It doesn't feel good running on that treadmill or whatever, or lifting those weights. But you know that this is how your soul breathes. It breathes like that. So befriend a new neighbor. Homeless are great people because they're different. We're all different. We all the other to each other, that we can slice our groups in so many ways. Expose yourself to a stranger in this group. You know, I've never been friends with that person, you know, because, you know, I'm not into that. That's good. Step in. But know that it requires energy. You cannot just do a lot of it. You have to sort of have a continual awkwardness in some part of your life. Because if you don't do that, if you overdo it, you start losing your sense of identity, or you need to be sort of rooted. And your roots will decide how much you can do it. The more rooted you are, the more you can do it. The more isolated you are, the shallower your roots. It's like almost like a nursery, you know. Once you remove the walls of the nursery, the roots need to go deeper. It's like Psalm 1, you know. Like the tree by the river will... You know, so you bring those roots in. So exposing yourself to others deepens you, and you're a very deep community because you're continually exposing yourself. But you're also coming together and saying, "This, thank you, stranger, wonderful. We've learned from you, Samir. Goodbye. And here's where we are. Here's what we do." And you keep going back to your well to drink. You know, you don't change wells or have 10 wells you're going to. Because if you dig 10 wells, you never hit the water. So you have to sort of have a staying power in where you are. So nurturing your rituals and tradition and who you are, and nurturing your beliefs, and renewing them all the time, renewing them, it's critical. Because if without that ground, you are, stranger doesn't know who you are. You cannot show up because you don't have yourself to show up. You don't know who you are. Because you're continually out there, you're never out, you are not there because there is no you to be there. So, okay. So that's a little bit of that. How much time we have? No. What time is it?
5 minutes.
Okay. All right.
I have a fun immersion experience to share. And I'll try and tell it really quickly. Sometimes it might take 5 minutes, but I won't put you through the whole thing. But I live in the East Mission in San Francisco, and we're right where the new culture foments, in my perspective, having lived there over 20 years. And I live about a block and a half from our neighborhood Walgreens, and there are usually a whole row of homeless. In fact, I often feel not very Christian, because I'm always telling the manager, you know, when we let you in here, it was your responsibility that this wasn't going to happen, you know, where it's constant panhandling. One day I was walking to Walgreens, and there was a man stretched out on the sidewalk. You get pretty jaded because it really gets to be a little close to home. And but he looked pretty bad. I couldn't see any part of his eyeball except the white part. And so I thought, I wonder if he's still here or if he's transitioning. Maybe I should call somebody. So went home and called the non-emergency number because I'm enough of a San Franciscan to know you don't call emergencies for things like that. And so I called the non-emergency number and explained that there's someone who doesn't look conscious and I'm not sure what their state is. And voice on the other said, "Are you with him now?" I said, "No, I came home to use the phone to call you." And they said, "Well, get right back there to him." And I'm saying, "Well, and what am I supposed to do?" "Well, try to arouse him." I'm going, "Well, I'm not really comfortable, you know, trying to lift him up." Or he said, "Well, see if you can move his foot or shout." So I run back and, you know, wiggle his foot with my shoe and shout, you know, "Are you okay, sir? Are you okay?" And nothing, absolutely no response, not a twitch. And I'm shouting, and now I'm, and I call him up again, you know, and they're not getting any response here. I'm, you know, and I'm making a lot of noise. He said, "Well, call 911. "Okay, call 911. Well, the fire engine comes, five big guys all helmeted, you know, hatchets. Everybody comes with this roaring engine, jumps off, sees me there. I'm kind of dressed. I didn't have my leopard shirt on, but a stocking cap. And they come up to me, "What's the problem, lady?" "Well, as soon as the fire engine arrives, this fellow leaps up off the pavement and swirling around like this, and the firemen come over to him. They think I'm his partner. So I can't convince him otherwise, and they're all down on me. All these big firemen are looking at me like, so what do I do? He's convincing them he's here for sure. And it's just fine, and they're, you know, they get back on their truck totally disgusted. So I'm standing there, and as they drive away, another fellow down the way, probably a vet on his milk crate, stands up and says, from here to the wall I'm standing, he points his finger at me and goes, "Yeah, lady, what's the matter with you wasting the taxpayer's dollar like that? So do your good works."
You should just say, "I pay taxes too." This was my call. Yeah. This is from the stuff I contributed, yeah. So, I think we can... wrap up. I was going to talk about the emptiness and importance of embracing a possibility that there's nothing there. In terms of... No, I opened the can of worms now, yes. But... because we don't know, see? So how do you live with these thoughts? Oh, what if there's only stars and ground under me and just me and my stories and stories we are spinning with each other? You know, how would I be Christian? How are you Christian in those moments? Because a rabbi told me, if you're not an atheist every 2 weeks, you are theologically comatose. So I want us to be honest about this empty part. Because emptiness, sense of that there is nothing, is not so scary as it seems. Genesis 1:1 starts with emptiness, and that was before. Emptiness was part of creation. Emptiness is something not to be scared about. Emptiness is something necessary in us for God to enter, for love to be there. A fallow field grows. Trees, you don't have many cherries here because they need 600 years of cold time, dormancy in order to do what they need to do. Emptiness above the waters is part of a creation process. So I wanted to talk about that, but that usually takes me an hour and a half. I'll finish with two short stories from my daughters, you know. my younger one, she was maybe like 4 or 5, and I was putting her to bed, and you know how these little ones are, they start asking all the serious questions at like 11:30 because they know you have been waiting for this all day. And so they ask you about meaning of life and boys and all that kind of stuff. And you cannot it's just very hard as a parent to turn back to that. So she said, why do we need to live? Why would we live forever? I cannot wrap my mind. She didn't wrap my mind. I don't understand eternity. Like, why would we need to live forever? It doesn't make sense to me. I'm like, how come it doesn't make sense to me? Would you like to live forever? She's like, I don't know. Trees die. Animals die. Everything goes. And then we would like stay. It doesn't make sense. I said, well, that's a mystery, I say, and that's the lamest answer you can give. but then I thought about that. If you think about Christ, he was willing to die for others to live. It's almost a dying. I approached my professor of theology years ago after I left the seminary. I said, what if I don't care about being in heaven? Like, is that okay? And he said, what do you mean? I said, I feel like if it's all about heaven, I'm like professional Christian. I do it for that. Like, it bothers me. It's like asking a child to do something nice and then giving them $10 at the end. Like, you don't. It's just a burden, you know. It's almost like celestial, sophisticated selfishness feel to me about it. Like, I want to be part of that. Can I just follow Jesus for the sake of just loving His ways, loving the way in the world to be like that? And whatever happens, happens afterwards. I asked Rabbi about, because Jewish people have this kind of a two opinions on the eternity, but mostly they don't care about it. So I said, like, what about eternity? He says, and he, it was a guy with a long beard and a black thing sitting, I was all day seminar with him. I said, what about it? He says, one world at a time, my son, one world at a time. So, what I want to say is, any theology that can help you be here and now, it's go there. Go there. I would rather live like Christ and not have eternity than live like however I want and have it. Walking in the kingdom of God now is more important to me than any prize that comes with it. And if the prize distracts me, I don't need it. I'll just even deny I don't need it. And there's a lot of stories like that in a Christian tradition, in a Jewish tradition, Talmud, as well as Christianity. One of the stories was, this is just drawing me in now. Anyway, I'll tell you about that story over lunch. But, so, that's one thing. Second is, relax. I realize I have to relax. The kingdom of God is bigger than what I'm doing, what we are doing. It's bigger than our time and place. The world didn't start with us. It's not going to finish with us. Our family didn't start with us. It's not going to finish with us. It is just such a privilege to participate and just be, to exist. I mean, this sense of like, somebody lifted a stone and the light came, and you realize that there's all this life that we have, and being aware of it and paying attention to it. The life gives itself to us as much as we pay attention. Attention is everything. It's a currency of everything. So I kind of gave up on changing the world. You know, I was sort of, I grew up in Croatia, and I was sort of Marxist country, and it's all about revolution. But in my mind, I was kind of revolution against the revolution. You know, I wanted to change a lot of things in my life, and came to some sort of peace. And I want to finish with one of the moments where kind of that sat down for me. It was about 4 years ago. My sister called me, and my dad, 2 days before that, was hospitalized, a problem with the heart, and out of nowhere. And so that he was in the hospital. So she calls me 2 days later, and she says, "Samir, dad is no more. Just passed away." So I was working at home, and I was alone, and so I didn't know what to do with it. I don't know whom to call, how to process, you know. And this is one of those moments in life when you realize you put things in perspective. You know, it just comes really unexpectedly and quickly. And so I decided, first of all, I took half an hour of my own, and I cried and I processed it, and I called my wife and I told her, and she'll come home early. And my daughter, she's well trained how to walk from school to home in a safe manner. And so whenever she finishes school, she needs to text me, "I'm coming home," meaning I've started walking. So if I don't show up in 20 minutes, you know, there's a problem. And so but this time she calls me and she says, "Oh, I'm leaving now." I said, "Okay." I just said, "Okay," nothing else. One word. I said, "Okay." So she comes home and I'm sitting on a sofa, and she walks in and she has a little paper bag with the corn muffins. We like corn muffins in our family. And so she says, "Oh, I bought you a muffin because I heard on the phone that you're sad." Okay. So I sit down and I said, "Okay, come sit down. I have something to tell you." You know. And she says, "Well, I have something to tell you too." I said, "Okay, who's going to go first?" And I said, "Okay, why don't you go first? I don't want to mess up the, you know, give her space." And she says, "I got my first period today." And then we spent some time, you know, talking about that. And then I told her what I had to say to her, and then we hugged and cried and all that. But the point of the story is that as one life closes, one womb opens. You know, look at us. It's a miracle that we're here. We're winning. You know, life is winning. Over a long period of time, if you look where humanity was and where it is, life is full of beautiful people, full of wonderful things to discover, you know, in any moment of our lives, every day. And things are just going to be fine. They're just going to turn. So I would say let's not take religion too seriously. You know, maybe take each other more seriously, take every moment more seriously, every day, and then you're safe. You just live in that wonder and generosity, and just follow your, do what you love, and love what you do. You know, that's my thing. Thank you.
Bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Samir. You've been a blessing to us. And we're going to be back here next week digging into the well, chapter 2 of your book.
All right. Dig in. Thank you.